from deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe. This is VSI Radio International. Learning is not attained by chance. It must be sought for with ardor and attended to with diligence. Finding out more and more that some kinds of radio are better than others, you are listening to the voice of the sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. Let us not dismiss the profound psychological effect that the mere appearance that someone is doing something can have on us. It can give us a calming sensation in moments of panic or irritation. It all depends on how convincing the appearance is, on the one hand, and how desperate we are to find a solution to whatever problem ails us, on the other. Those of us old enough to remember the old "please stand by" announcements on television that now and then would pop up on the screen whenever there was a technical difficulty might know what I mean. Presumably, the kinds of technical difficulties that would prompt such a measure in the past do not pose as much of a problem today, given the way in which the technology has progressed, as it is very seldom that we see "please stand by" on telly anymore. However, I can still remember "please stand by" being a fairly common occurrence, perhaps once or twice per week. Now, I'm no expert in the field of television broadcasting, so I cannot say for sure, and certainly someone listening will know better than I do, but it seemed that toward the late 80s and early 90s, the "please stand by" screen came on quite suddenly while the program I was watching seemed to be running just fine. Perhaps there was some kind of instant error trapping routine that immediately detected that something was about to go wrong and then automatically switched to "please stand by." However, in the late 70s and early 80s, and remember that I was in my single-digit years of age back then, I do half recall there being a few seconds when the sound would fade, or the picture blur or go fuzzy, or some strange flickering of the image would occur for several seconds before the "please stand by" screen was shown. I probably would not recall that at all had it not been for the consistently predictable behavior of those others in my house watching the telly with me. As soon as a bit of flickering or poor sound quality occurred, those others watching the telly in the room, be it my father, a cousin, or a babysitter, would loudly exclaim in panic, "What's going on here? What's the matter with the telly?" Or even, "Come on, are the guys at the TV station blind?" There would be a noisy turmoil in the recreation room for the few seconds it took from the time the technical difficulty was first encountered until the appearance of the "please stand by" screen. It was amazing how much tinkering could be done in those approximately 5 seconds. Everything from hitting the side of the teleceiver several times with an open hand, to quickly switching channels back and forth a few dozen times, to looking at the back of the set in order to see whether the antenna wire came unconnected, or any number of equally futile attempts to ascertain the problem. Considering that the problem was clearly at the source, the TV transmitting station, I really don't know what subjecting the TV set to such battery was going to accomplish. I recall one occasion while watching the telly with a much older cousin. In fact, I remember we were watching Chips. The station experienced a technical difficulty, and it was taking an unusually long time for the "please stand by" screen to show. My cousin, who was only mildly irritated at first, began the customary rapid changing of the channels, only to find that all the other channels were coming in fine. And remember, this was back in the days before the remote control. He was down on his knees in front of the receiver, wildly turning the knob back and forth. But finally, he tuned back to the channel he was originally watching, only to see that the picture was still flickering wildly, and that still no "please stand by" screen was visible. At that point, he became loudly excited and repeatedly slapped the side of the teleceiver. My older cousin, never one to mind his language, not even in mixed company or in front of young children, then loudly began, in rather colorful terms, to accuse the television set, an inanimate, lifeless, non-biological device, of incest and fornication. At last, after about 30 seconds, the "Please Stand By" screen finally appeared, at which point my loud and short-tempered cousin suddenly fell quiet and retreated back to sit on the sofa once more. He turned to me and assured me that they were fixing it and the show will be back on in a minute. As it turns out, it must have been quite a complicated problem, as it took nearly 3 minutes before the program was on again. But during that entire time, my cousin sat perfectly calmly and stared at the screen. Eventually, Chips was on again, and it was like nothing had happened. I'm sure that many others have recognized this among certain members of their own family. What strikes me now as having been very odd was the immediate soothing effect that the three words, "Please stand by," has on people. Most people have no idea how a TV transmitting station works, or what it is that goes wrong when the "Please Stand By" screen is shown. Has one of the videotape reels fallen off? Had a splice in the film come undone and needed to be reconnected? Has one of the playback heads worn down? We don't know. We have no clue how to fix it, nor do we know what is going on behind the scenes. We don't know how many technicians are working on the problem or how long it will take, but as long as "Please Stand By" is showing, we sit patiently and calmly, safe in the knowledge that someone, somewhere, is in control and is doing something about it. With that in mind, we can wait calmly for several minutes, while just 5 seconds of a flickering picture drives some of us crazy. What we forget is that the "Please Stand By" still means that something's wrong. We are no better off, and we have no idea how much closer we are to a solution. All we know is that someone is doing something, so we think. The calming effect that comes over us whenever we see someone take charge of a situation is curious. Why do we tend to feel a sense of calm upon encountering a person in uniform, everyone from a policeman or soldier, down to the telephone repairman or cinema usher? We get the sense that someone in charge is necessarily expert in addressing some problem, and that, at least if someone credible is at the helm, we're not really interested in how to fix the problem, or what the problem really is. We are just glad to see somebody doing something. All we need to do is just "Please stand by." Perhaps that is why, in spite of the discomfort, we tolerate the increasing presence of the authorities in matters of security right after serious incidents occur, be it a terror attack or a natural disaster. We like to think that some official body has prepared for just such an eventuality, and that some men in uniform will be busy doing something about such predicaments. We once trusted that the right people were doing something to prepare us for the dubious Y2K bug, and today the equally dubious problems of climate change. And moreover, too many of us trust that there are clever people in the know doing something about the state of the economy. That's not to say that there's no lingering anxiety as long as such problems remain with us, but some semblance of order seems to be restored as soon as a highly esteemed figure in a suit and tie, a military uniform, or a lab coat goes public and assures us all that something is being done to contend with whatever dire circumstance faces us. We may not know exactly what the problems are, or how one proposes to solve them. Certainly, the powers that be are quick to step onto the scene following some devastating event, and usually some bad law comes out of it. At very least, immediately after some dreadful catastrophe, there's a lot of clamoring for bad law, i.e., an increase in state power at the expense of individual liberty. After the Oklahoma City bombing, the American people were told that they needed to come to grips with the dangers of people being extended too much freedom. Every school shooting is instantly followed up by the war cries of the anti-gun paranoiacs that want the state to disarm law-abiding people, while speaking nothing of disarming the state. The terror attacks of 9/11 provided the impetus behind an ever-increasing number of encroachments on civil liberties and the invasion of privacy, ultimately culminating in the TSA. We tolerate these things for a few reasons. Firstly, they tend to be implemented quickly after the shocking event that gives rise to them, so that people have not calmed down enough to give such matters rational thought. As long as people are upset, they will want somebody just to do something, anything about it. Hence, we get bad laws and an ever-increasing presence of the state in our lives, ostensibly for our own good, but which in reality provide nothing more but the appearance of something important being done. Now, long-term listeners to WBCQ and to shortwave radio in general have heard all manners of conspiracy theories. I remember Tom Valentine and Radio Free America in 1995 telling the world an elaborate conspiracy theory concerning the Oklahoma City bombing. He, too, got into the 9/11 conspiracy theory, as have many others. The general logic is that the government needs a pretext to expand its own powers or to go to war, and thus they're behind such murderous attacks and are covering up their own complicity while blaming someone else. Often, the State of Israel or the Mossad in particular are blamed in some theories. The kinds of people who read and watch news may be susceptible to falling for such conspiracy theories, though, in fairness, most news junkies tend not to believe it, to their credit. Still, those who read history or philosophy, and those of you who have been reading Albert Nock's Our Enemy the State in particular, realize that there is no need to resort to conspiracy theories. You know that through history, the state has taken advantage of every contingency in order to increase its power at the expense of individual liberty, and that the contingencies we face today are no different. It's not part of some dark and elaborate scheme planned by some cabal of nefarious malefactors. Rather, it is simply the nature of the state as such, and in spite of the great advances in human freedom and its protection through the common law, the Constitution of the United States, and in Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence in general, even the sturdiest rock of liberty will eventually be eroded away by the constant undulation of statism as each wave is fed by one tumultuous contingency after the other. Serious students of history and civilization were not at all surprised by 9/11. History shows us that Islam has been a thorn in the side of civilized men since its inception, and in modern history, at least since 1979, the West has buckled under to terrorism as the attacks have become worse and worse. Starting with the hostage crisis in Iran in 1979, continuing with such things as the hijacking of the Achille Lauro, the blowing up of the USS Cole, the bombing in Beirut, the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, to mention but a few off the top of my head, these are cases of dreadful instances about which the men in uniform did virtually nothing. The acts got bolder and bolder with time until they culminated in 9/11. The historical lesson repeated itself, namely that appeasement in the face of evil only leads to more and more brazen acts. Thus, a serious student of civilization and history does not need to resort to conspiracy theories regarding 9/11. Such an attack was very much to be expected. That's not to say that I predicted the event in particular, and indeed the scope and magnitude of the attack, were stunning. But it does not surprise me that a handful of murderous Arab fanatics would pull something like this off and use their religion as a justification. I can believe that there are many details surrounding the event that the government of the United States is keeping quiet, but overall, the official story of what happened is probably very close to the truth. There are quite simply some contingencies for which we cannot be prepared, and that extends even to the highest and best-equipped government agencies. Many of us find this unsettling. Those who put their trust in the state have a profound emotional and psychological need to believe that absolutely everything is planned. Never mind the necessary implication that, if 9/11 indeed were a government conspiracy, then the government on which one depends is truly a diabolical one. But if the American people can somehow find out or reason that the government was behind such an evil act, they can take comfort, yes, a comfort, in believing that they were always in control, that nothing happens without the state pulling the strings. If somehow the Americans can blame their own government, they can trick themselves into believing that they can find a simple answer in replacing the powers that be with more honest ones, and they can continue to believe that their country and its institutions are invincible. Surely, terrorism is something for which you and I, on an individual level, cannot reasonably be expected to be prepared. Yet, as dreadful as it is, terrorism is something that strikes very, very few people, and is statistically not a significant threat to the everyday lives of most people. However, there are more serious and widespread perils that face us, and I wonder how well prepared we are to contend with them. I'm not talking merely about emergencies, but what if suddenly our own personal, economic, or family circumstances suddenly required us to make long-term changes to our lifestyles, perhaps a permanent paradigm shift in our coping skills and in how we survive? Even setting aside such possibilities as nuclear war or widespread social disorder, there are disasters that strike us, and they do not need even to be as calamitous as an earthquake or hurricane. Take, for instance, the profound convenience offered by the modern supermarket. Thanks to the technology of refrigeration and motorized haulage, town dwellers today are able to eat a variety of fresh foods from all over the world. For relatively little money, you can get a pineapple anytime you like. The only downside I see to this distribution system is that those of us who depend on it become very vulnerable should any disruption in supply occur. Again, it may not even take a tsunami or an outbreak of war to cut off the supply. Just here in my town 2 years ago, the highway was so completely snowed in that no traffic could get in or out for 3 consecutive days. The advantage we get in constantly having fresh food available to us year-round carries with it the disadvantage of having no more than about 3 days' worth of food. Naturally, on the third day, there was a run on the supermarkets, and the shelves were quickly going bare. Thankfully, it was possible to open the road on the fourth day, and shipments could enter the town. Had it not been opened, there was talk of using large military helicopters, essentially to do a relief delivery. Now, the town I live in has 20,000 people. If you live in a much smaller town, I'm not sure how likely any kind of airlift would be considered. While we were saved in the nick of time, I could not help but to wonder how many people in this town planned for this very contingency, which was not at all unlikely and could strike again next winter. How many had canned, jarred, or freeze-dried food stored up in the house? And in general, if our remote town at any other time of the year faced a supply shortage, how many of our townsfolk would simply wait and go hungry until some other agent, probably the state, was able to relieve their need? And how many of us would know where the mushroom and berry patches were, where wild game could be caught? How many people in town have their own vegetable gardens in their backyards, and how many know how to pickle or otherwise preserve their homegrown vegetables? Now, I am by no means anti-technology or anti-commerce. I recognize that in the vast majority of cases, it is far more beneficial, both financially and in terms of time, to sell your time and skill to someone else needing to buy your specialized labor, and then for you to go buy food from a commercial-scale supplier. I know that sounds crass and unromantic to many, but it is a reality, and even if you are the kind that is dead set on being fully self-sufficient, it is still to your benefit that commercial food distribution exists and that enough people patronize it so that it is there when you do need it. Still, I think that simple gardening skills, as well as fishing and hunting or trapping skills, if not a knowledge of raising some form of livestock, should be possessed by responsible adults. Even if they're not going to engage in such things, having a couple of books on the topic, perhaps even e-books so they're not in the way, should be available. Now, I've listened to quite a fair share of so-called survivalist radio shows on shortwave and have read such books. While I find a lot of the information to be invaluable, that's not really what I'm talking about. I think that homesteading and self-sufficiency can be taken to a new level where it can be interwoven with modern technology and convenience, a sort of homesteading 2.0. Quite simply, there are times when it is of greater benefit to buy things you need from a commercial outlet, and other times you'll find that provided you have the needed skills and resources, that producing a product or service for yourself will be more economical. This may still involve the use of technology. If you have some romantic notion of building a log cabin on the shores of Walden Pond and living a materially simple life, then by all means you can do that, but I think a sober reflection will reveal that most of us would not thrive by doing that. Homesteading 2.0 It is more a matter of providing yourself with more choices, not fewer, when faced with various and varying personal circumstances.
Down in the street, they're all singing and shouting, staying alive though the city's dead, hiding their shame behind a hollow laughter while you are crying alone on your bed. Pity Cassandra, let no one believe you, but then again lost from the start. Now we must suffer and sell our secrets, bargain, playing smart, aching in our hearts.
Sorry, Cassandra.
Sorry, Cassandra, I didn't believe you.
The world once again faces the prospect of a highly destructive global conflict. If that happens, it will be a very difficult time indeed, and perhaps the survivalists' approach will be more appropriate. However, even if such a world war does not materialize, the economic woes from which the world suffers will present many challenges to our survival and well-being, and you will want as many options available to you as possible. And don't think that because countries like New Zealand, Canada, or this country, Sweden, have so far been spared the worst of the financial crisis, that there's no worry for us. It's been difficult here as well. I've both benefited and lost from the crisis, and it will do people in these countries well to consider the options that some kind of self-sufficiency measures will give them. Indeed, men in suits and uniforms have been promising to do something about the poor economy, but their actions have not provided results, and their promises are thus very uninspiring. Instead of waiting for the national and international economy to recover and then to trickle down to you, it would probably be better on a day-to-day basis to regard the world economy in the same way as we regard the weather. It is a phenomenon over which we have no control, but we still need to contend with it and get on with our business. The weather analogy is indeed most apt. We adjust our behaviors and choose what to wear based on the weather. If it's snowing, we put on a thick wool overcoat. If it's raining, we put on a raincoat and a pair of Wellingtons. If it is a bright summer afternoon and 110 degrees in the shade, well, you better have your sunglasses and drink plenty of water. At any given moment, we might find the weather to be inconvenient or even profoundly detrimental to our plans. But we don't blame low-pressure systems, cold fronts, or cumulus clouds for their lack of regulation and for having set out to get us with their predatory precipitation. We simply accept that there are some things we can change and some things we cannot, and adjust accordingly. Similarly, when the economy is booming and when the money you can earn in 1 hour can buy you more food than you could possibly dig out of your backyard garden in an entire day, then you simply sell your labor to someone else and buy your food commercially. However, as the economy fails and you find that prices of food rise while you are earning less and less, your backyard garden becomes more and more interesting. And if you are working less and there is less of a demand for your particular commercial skill, the return on your time invested in your vegetable garden is pure profit, as it were. Those of you who have been reading Albert Nock may remember the following concerning the situation of high unemployment in his time. The essence of the predicament of his time remains true today. Nock writes, "Consider, for example, the present situation. Our natural resources, while much depleted, are still great. Our population is very thin, running something like 20 or 25 to the square mile, and some millions of this population are at the moment unemployed, and likely to remain so because no one will or can give them work. The point is not that men generally submit to this state of things, or that they accept it as inevitable, but that they see nothing irregular or anomalous about it, because of their fixed idea that work is something to be given." End quote. In our time, there are even more resources available in the form of modern technology. Self-sufficiency becomes a more realistic enterprise, given that we now have such things as robotic lawnmowers, for instance, which I think are surprisingly late to come onto the market. Large vegetable gardens can be double dug and plants placed more closely together in order to minimize the need for weeding. And the watering can be done automatically using simple-to-build electronic circles that monitor water in the soil and then control a valve carefully set so that the plants are watered optimally using a variety of watering techniques not available in Nock's time. Let us not forget the motherlode of information, the internet. Much maligned for its misuse and intrusion into our privacy, let us not forget that all sorts of information regarding self-sufficiency can be found online, and not only that, the internet allows you to take many forms of business, from cottage industries to international commercial concerns, everywhere. In my own line of work, that is in translating printed texts into English, I can be physically located anywhere in the world as long as there's some kind of internet hookup. Indeed, this is what allowed me to relocate and move deep into the Swedish forest, where costs are extremely low, in what is otherwise a prohibitively expensive country. Customers from all over the world send me work. As Knock suggested, we need to get out of the mindset of jobs being something to be given. In a failed economy, self-sufficiency will not allow job seekers to look around for people offering work. Yes, they will always exist, but you cannot count on it, and in fact you may do better to keep your independence. Even if you're steadily employed now, you should have a standby plan, a means of generating some income on the side. Do you have any hobbies that could be turned into something that could be tradable? Could you devote some time to learning some such skill? If you play the piano, do you think you could teach someone else? This is the manner in which you should start thinking. While I translate full-time, I'm also learning about electronics and how to build my own circuits. This could come in handy both as a tradable skill and in my own homesteading activities. One of the most important things to obtain for homesteading and self-sufficiency is some form of a plot of land. Apartment dweller homesteading will be highly limited, and it does not afford the same possibilities for self-sufficiency. Even if you live in a suburban neighborhood, you could probably turn your back garden, or a substantial part thereof, into a vegetable patch. You can collect rain and snow for water, and of course, you can erect long wire antennas for shortwave and ham radios. Still, using the appropriate kinds of modern technology, I think even a single individual can and should be able to turn a one-acre parcel of land into a self-sufficient homestead, providing for almost all of his needs and eliminating his need to rely on working for a living. Now, let me make it clear that if you are working, I think you should keep your job and ease into homesteading of this sort. You should earn money to obtain those things that you cannot reasonably produce yourself. A hardcore, purely self-sufficient homesteader should be the first one to tell you that homesteading is not for everyone. In fact, it is much to the benefit of a homesteader that not everyone does it. Given a vibrant, free economy, large-scale commercial production remains the most efficient way of producing and distributing goods. And while you may find that you are an expert in planting vegetables, baking bread, digging wells, planting trees, brewing beer, and milking cows all in one day, the moment you need to find a pound of nails, you'll be glad that you can slap a few dollar bills onto a counter at the hardware store and get them, and not have to master blacksmithing and make your own, or trade with some other homesteader who's a blacksmith, at a price in coin or barter that is far greater. You see, homesteading should not be seen as a rejection of modernity or of commercial enterprise. Rather, it is simply one more option that allows people into a large-scale economy who are otherwise locked out. As long as the governments of the world continue to manipulate the economy and redistribute wealth, as long as payroll taxes and benefits continue to price jobs out of the market, as long as capital is not allowed to flow freely and to accumulate, there will always be a portion of the population for whom no work will be offered, even amidst an abundance of natural and human resources, as well as a long list of tasks needing to be done. Far from rejecting modern technology, I see the possibility for a new growth sector in technology for self-sufficiency. It will include new horizons in robotics, energy production, agricultural and chemical engineering, construction, and communications. Instead of resorting to such stopgap measures as survivalism, homesteading 2.0 can become a lifestyle that many will choose to maintain even if and when the economy as a whole improves. It will allow greater flexibility for people to come and to go and to find what is most economically beneficial for them.
Good morning, sunshine. There's love in your skies, reflecting the sunlight in my lover's eyes. Good morning, sunshine. So happy.
I really enjoy the feedback I've been getting, and I hope more and more of you will drop me a line. If you'd like to get in touch with VSI Radio International, please send me an email at feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden exclusively for WBCQ, transmitting out of Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. I rather wrestled with how to go about discussing any practical matters considering homesteading, as every experience is going to be different. Certainly, homesteading in the Swedish forests will present a very different set of circumstances than homesteading on the plains of Nebraska. The most obvious difference is the availability of trees and standing wood generally, which is the environment with which I'm most familiar. During the years I lived in Iceland, which is virtually treeless in most of the country, I often wondered how one could possibly go about homesteading there. I wouldn't know where to begin without a reliable source of wood. Of course, people in the past who first settled that country found a way. However, throughout the history of that country, wood was and continues to be a vital and primary import. This may defeat the purpose of homesteading in the minds of many. I've spent quite a bit of time living in tents, even in the winter, and I have a rather romantic notion of staking out a claim and building the site from scratch. I have no problem with tents. Preferably, but not necessarily, if I were to spend winter in a tent, I would want one into which a wood stove could be installed. What is important is to be up off the ground and to stay dry. On the west coast of Sweden, winter is pretty miserable, as the air is always heavy and damp. It's the kind of cold that gets right through to your bones, no matter what you're wearing. Now that I live far inland, I find that winters are much colder when looking at the thermometer, but since the air is drier, the cold is more tolerable. Once I find the space to place my tent, I remove all the hard sticks and stones and anything else that would be uncomfortable or which might puncture the bottom of my tent. Then I cut down pine boughs, not the entire branches, but simply make a collection of pine needles and form a thick rectangular cover over the area onto which I will place my tent. I make sure that the rectangular area formed by the pine boughs is somewhat larger than the tent area, and I find that I cannot really pile them on too high as they will eventually pack down under the weight of the tent and of me inside it. Allow yourself the time to collect plenty of pine boughs. The layer of pine boughs under the tent should be as much as 8 inches thick if you can manage it. I then put the tent on top of this layer of pine boughs. Don't worry if you get a huge bulge in the tent floor. It will pack down before too long. What I find that this does is several things. It provides a significant amount of padding, and you can sleep in a sleeping bag right on the floor without any kind of mat. But more importantly, it lifts you up off the cold ground. Still more importantly, it provides you with considerable protection from heavy rains, as any water flowing in under the tent will be able to flow away from it easily without pooling. Even in especially rainy weather, you'll find that the pine boughs help to distribute the weight on the ground and keep you from sinking into the mud. Stay away from the sides of the tent as well, especially in a canvas tent, as you will get wet no matter how waterproof it is. There are a few things more miserable than having to crawl into a damp sleeping bag on a rainy night in a tent. In the winter, allow the snow to build up along the sides of the tent, as this provides excellent insulation. Depending on the size of the tent, especially on how high it is, your body heat alone will heat up the space inside and it can become quite toasty. However, even in the winter, make sure that you have at least some ventilation. Now, I suppose that so far that this really falls into the category of camping and not homesteading. Personally, I have no problem living in tents, and I would continue to do so while I secured a source of water, set up some kind of sanitary facilities, planted a garden, and even set up some manner of electrical generation before I even thought about a more permanent housing. Even then, I might opt to put a small caravan or camper on the site and equip it for more rugged use and cold weather, and use that until I was able to build a proper dwelling exactly to my tastes. And even then, I would continue to try to think outside of the box. Do I build a log cabin? Do I build a cottage with earthen walls and a thatched roof? Maybe even a dugout or fully underground house in the side of a hill would be ideal. Until then, provided that it's watertight and functional, the camper will be sufficient and other priorities should be tended to first. I realize that this will sound exciting to some people, but to others, especially with those with families, this would actually be a huge step backward. And not everyone in the family would likely do well in such an arrangement, in particular, those who have become accustomed to a life with far more amenities. In such cases, it might be wiser to buy a property that already has a functional house on site, with enough land and perhaps a few outbuildings, in order to engage in self-sufficient activities. Don't forget that you're going to take advantage of modern technology, not shun it, in making self-sufficiency a realistic prospect. Depending on where you live, this may well entail buying a farm, but if you don't want the hassle of running an entire farming operation, remember that neighbor farmers are often in the market to rent land for cultivation. Remember to keep an acre or two for yourself and your activities, and then the revenue you earn from renting out the rest of the farm may well be sufficient to cover all your financial needs. Otherwise, and if you're still relatively young, this may be a more reliable plan than a 401k, you can plant hardwood trees, especially something like black walnut, which does take quite a bit of care at the initial stages, but is quite hardy after a few years. As your hardwood plantation grows, it will attract bird life and other fauna that will contribute to the biodiversity of your area and keep harmful insects away. In about 30 years' time, you can sell the mature hardwood trees to a lumber company, probably for several million dollars. They will even do the work of cutting and carrying away the trees for you. Another valuable hardwood tree is oak, if you're in the right climate for it. However, any financial benefit from it will likely need to be left to a future and yet unborn generation. Still, if you have a large family and intend to pass your homestead on, this may very well be appropriate. The topic of homesteading and self-sufficiency is very large, and so if you're interested, I would like to recommend a website that I found very recently. It's quite simply www.homesteadingtoday.com. That's www.homesteadingtoday.com. Homesteadingtoday.com. Now, this site is really just a discussion forum, but it goes back to at least 2005 and involves many people who've been involved in all manners of homesteading. I'm not personally involved in this site, so I can't vouch for anything discussed, but I know that anyone interested in homesteading and self-sufficiency, whether you're new to the topic or a seasoned veteran of the art, will find something interesting. It is certainly an extremely well-organized forum, with some very specific threads making it easy to look up any discussion and to find relevant information. There are threads concerning the raising of specific types of livestock, being chickens, pigs, rabbits, a discussion on raising, and the use of guard animals. Moreover, there are a few generalized forums dealing with homesteading as a broad topic, as well as a homesteading store with items for sale. There's furthermore a homesteading families thread where you can network and socialize with other families interested in homesteading. Other self-sufficiency measures are discussed as well. There are forums about homeschooling, running home-based businesses, alternative energy, cooking, sewing, baking, food preservation. There's even a barter board. So, short of making an all-out advertisement for this webpage, I suggest that anyone interested in homesteading take a look at www.homesteadingtoday.com and have a look around. I trust that you've been sufficiently inspired and now have something interesting to read up on, at least until next week. Remember once more that if you'd like to get in contact with me, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. Already in the past 7 weeks, I've learned a lot from those of you who've been sending me feedback, and I like to think that VSI is a two-way communication project, at least in as much as a radio broadcast can be. So if you have anything to say about homesteading, maybe you've done it yourself, please tell me more about it. And with that, I'd like to leave you with the words of Confucius: the strength of a nation derives from the integrity of the home.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.